Her heart quivers a few times, then stops. It all goes quiet. It feels as if she's wading out into warm water, a silver-grey river that's flowing gently on into the night. Chapter 51. The police have only had the third film for 80 minutes when the emergency call center receives a phone call from a woman who says in a monotone that her daughter has been murdered. The time is 4:45 when Margot parks her Lincoln Town Car in front of the fluttering tape of the police cordon. The policeman who went inside to see if the victim could be saved is sitting on the step of the neighboring doorway. His face is gray, and there's a dark look in his eyes. A paramedic puts a blanket round his shoulders and checks his blood pressure as Adam talks to him. The woman who found her daughter is in hospital with her sister. Margot makes a mental note to go and talk to her later, once the tranquilizers have softened the burning layer of pain and shock. While Margot was driving to Hegerstein, she'd called Yuna at the hospital to tell him about the third murder. He sounded very tired, but listened to everything she told him, and for some strange reason, that made her feel calmer. Margot passes the inner cordon and enters the hallway of the block of flats. Floodlights illuminate the stairwell, reflecting off the glass covering the list of residents' names. Margot pulls on some shoe protectors and carries on past the forensics officers who are setting out stepping plates in silence. She stops in the harsh glare of the floodlights. The metal clicks as it heats up. The smell of warm blood and urine is overpowering and acrid. A forensics officer is filming the room according to a set procedure. On the linoleum floor sits a woman with an utterly ravaged face, her chest split open, her glasses have fallen off into the pool of blood beside the table. She's lying with her hand over her left breast. Her soft skin shimmers pearly white beneath her blood-blackened hand. She has evidently been placed in that position after death, but it doesn't look particularly sexual. Margot stands there for a few moments, looking at the devastating scene, at the display of brutality, the blood sprayed out by a stabbing knife, the arterial spatter on the smooth door of a kitchen cupboard, and the smeared blood left by the victim's struggle and the spasmodic jerking of her body. They know far too little about the second murder, but this one seems to follow the pattern of the first exactly. The level of brutality is inconceivable and appears to extend far beyond the moment of death. Once the fury of the attack subsided, the body was arranged slightly before being left at the scene of the murder. In the first case, the victim's fingers had been inserted into her mouth, and this time, her hand is covering her breast. Margot steps aside to make way for one of the forensic officers who is laying out boards on the floor. With her hand on her protruding stomach, she carries on into the bedroom and looks down into the open drawer at the porcelain deer, chestnut brown, except for the break where the head should be. After a while, she returns to the victim. She stares once again at the carefully staged arrangement of the hand on her chest, and a thought flits through her head and vanishes. There's something she recognizes. Margot stands for a while and thinks before leaving the flat and going back to her car. She starts the engine and holds one hand on the wheel and the other on her stomach, moves it down to counter the baby's rapid movements with her fingertips, the small nudges from the other side, from the beginning. She tries to make herself more comfortable, but the steering wheel presses against her stomach. "What is it I can't quite remember?" she thinks. It could have been 5 years ago in a different police district, but I definitely read something. Something about the hands or the deer. She can't help thinking that she won't get any sleep tonight if she doesn't work out what it is. Margot turns into Pulhelmsgatan and pulls up beside the rock face. Her phone rings and Margot sees the picture of Jenny in her cowboy hat from Tucson on the screen. "National crime," Margot answers. "I need to report a crime," Jenny says. "If it's urgent, you should call 112," she says, parking more neatly. "But otherwise, this is a crime against public decency," Jenny interrupts. "Can you be a bit more specific?" Margot asks, opening the car door. "If you come here, I can show you." Margot has to take the phone from her ear as she gets out of the car and locks it. "Sorry, what did you say?" "I just called to find out where you'd got to," Jenny says in a different tone of voice. "I'm on Kungsholmen. I've got to..." "You haven't got time. You need to come home straight away," she cuts in. "What's happened?" "Seriously, Margot, this is hopeless. For God's sake, you were the one who picked Sunday. They'll all be here any minute." "Don't be cross with me. I just can't let go of this case before..." "You're not coming?" Jenny interrupts. "Is that what you're saying?" "I thought it was next weekend," Margot replies. "How the hell could you think that?" Margot had completely forgotten about dinner with her family. The idea was for her and Jenny to thank everyone for their support during the Pride Festival. Everyone who had marched with banners saying "Proud Parents and Families." "You'll just have to explain that I'll be a bit late," she says, stopping 10 meters from the entrance to police headquarters. "Look, this isn't on," Jenny says, then takes a deep breath. "I'm actually feeling pretty let down. You got a career opportunity, and I was happy to support you and look after the children while I worked. And now I'm working, just like..." "But you're working the whole bloody time." "And that was what we agreed," Margot interrupts. She starts walking towards the entrance as a colleague comes out and unlocks the heavy chain around the rear wheel of a motorbike. "Okay, that was what we agreed," Jenny says quietly. "I've got to go now, but I'll be home as soon as..." Margot stops when she realizes that Jenny has hung up on her. She carries on into the lobby, passes the security doors, and heads towards the lifts. "Maria Carlson, the first victim, had her hand in her mouth," Margot thinks once more. That wasn't enough for her to discern a pattern, but when she saw Sandra Lundgren lying there with her hand over one breast, she had a fleeting sense of a connection. It didn't look natural. It was arranged. She walks along the empty corridor to her office, closes the door behind her, and sits down at the computer and searches for arranged bodies. She can hear sirens from emergency vehicles somewhere. Margot kicks off her shoes as she clicks through the results. Nowhere does she find any similarity to her murders. Her stomach feels tight, and she undoes her belt altogether. She expands the search to cover the whole country, and when the list of results appears, she knows she's found what she was looking for. A murder in Salem. The victim was found with her hand round her own neck. She had been arranged like that after she died. The preliminary investigation had been conducted by the Södertälje Police District. As she read, she remembered more details. Far too much had leaked to the press. The extreme level of brutality had been focused primarily on the victim's face and upper body. The dead woman had been found in her bathroom with her hand around her own throat. The victim's name was Rebecca Hansson. She had been wearing pajama bottoms and a sweater, and according to the post-mortem, she had not been subjected either to rape or attempted rape. Margot's heart is pounding in her chest as she finds the information about Rocky Kirklund, a priest. She reads that an arrest warrant was issued for him in his absence, and he was subsequently apprehended in connection with a traffic accident. The forensic evidence against him was compelling. Rocky Kirklund underwent a forensic psychiatric examination and was consigned to Karlsruden District Hospital, with specific restrictions placed on any parole application. "I've found the murderer," Margot thinks, and her hand is trembling as she reaches for the phone and calls Karlsruden Hospital. When she finds out that Rocky Kirklund is locked up and that he has never been let out on license, she demands an immediate meeting with the head of security. Barely 2 hours later, Margot is sitting in the office of the head of security, Neil Lindgren, in the gleaming white main building, discussing the security arrangements for Section D4. Neil is a thick-set man with a fleshy forehead and neat, stubby hands. He leans back in his chair as he explains the secure perimeter fences, the alarm system, the airlock, and pass cards. "That all sounds very good," Margot says when Neil falls silent. "But the question is, could Rocky Kirklund have managed to get out anyway?"
"You're welcome to meet him, if that would make you feel any better," he smiles.
"You're absolutely sure you'd have noticed if he escaped and came back the same day?"
"No one's escaped," Neil says.
"But hypothetically," Margot goes on, "if he got out immediately after you did your round at 8 o'clock, when would he have to be back today in order for his absence not to be noticed?"
Neil's smile fades and his hands fall to his lap.
"Today is Sunday," he says slowly. "He wouldn't need to be back before 5 o'clock. But, you know, the doors are locked and alarmed, and the whole area is covered by surveillance cameras."
Chapter 52. On a large monitor, 30 squares show what's being picked up by the facility's security cameras. A technician in his 60s shows Margot the system of CCTV cameras, motion-activated cameras, their locations, and the laser and infrared barriers. Recordings from the surveillance cameras are stored for a maximum of 30 days.
"This is Section D4, he says, pointing. "The corridor, day room, exercise yard, fence, the outside of the fence, the outside of the building, and these show the park and the driveway."
The monitor shows an image of the hospital as it was at 5 o'clock that morning. The static glow from the lamps make the park look strangely lifeless. The clock in the corner of the screen moves on, but everything remains perfectly still. When the man speeds up the replay, a few trees appear to move in the wind. The nighttime security guard walks along the corridor and disappears into the staff room. Suddenly, the technician stops the film and points at an area of grass that spreads out like a patch of grey water. Margot leans forward and sees a number of dark shapes against the bushes and trees. The technician enlarges the image and plays the footage. 3 deer appear in the glow of a lamp. They walk across the grass, all stop at once, stand still with their necks craned, then carry on. He shrinks the image and hits fast forward again. Daylight arrives, and the transparent shadows grow sharper as the sun rises. Cars arrive, and staff go inside and spread out through the corridors and tunnels. The technician stops the recordings to show the night staff leaving. Margot watches the morning round in the various sections, in silence. There's very little activity, given that it's Sunday. There's no sign of Rocky Kirklund among the patients who have opted to go out into the exercise yard. They carry on fast-forwarding, stopping occasionally to look more closely at anyone in the corridors, but everything seems to be calm as the hours tick by.
"And here you are," the technician says with a smile. He enlarges one square to show her struggling to get out of her car, and her wrap dress slips open, revealing her pink underwear.
"Whoops," she mumbles.
Margot sees herself walk across the car park with her big leather bag over her shoulder, her hands round her stomach. She goes round the corner of the building and disappears from view, but the next camera picks her up outside the entrance. At the same time, she is visible from another angle on a camera above the reception desk in the lobby.
"I disappeared for a few seconds as I went round the corner of the building," she says.
"No," he says calmly.
"It felt like it," she insists.
He goes back to the image of her getting out of her car, flashing her underwear, follows her across the car park, and stops the recording as she walks round the corner of the building and disappears from that screen.
"We've got a camera here that ought to..."
He enlarges another square, showing the end of the building and lots of leaves, but not her. He plays the footage slowly, and she comes into view outside the entrance.
"Okay, you're gone for a few seconds," he eventually says. "There are always going to be tiny gaps in the system.
Could someone exploit them to escape?"
The technician leans back, and the wad of chewing tobacco beneath his lip slips down over one of his teeth as he shakes his head.
"Not even theoretically," he says firmly.
"How certain are you of that?"
"Pretty much 100%, he replies.
"Okay,"
Margot says.
She gets up laboriously from her chair and thanks him for his help. If Rocky couldn't have escaped, she's going to have to think again. The murder he committed has to be linked to the recent killings. There are no coincidences on that level. The priest must have had someone helping him, an apprentice on the outside, she thinks to herself. Unless they're dealing with a completely independent copycat, or someone with whom Rocky Kirklund has been communicating. The technician leads her back through the deserted corridors to Neil Lindegren's room. The head of security is talking to a woman in a white coat when Margot walks in.
"I need to talk to Rocky Kirklund," she says.
"But it's not even certain that he'll be able to remember what he's been doing today," Neil says, gesturing towards the doctor.
"Kirklund has a serious neurological injury," the doctor explains. "His memories only come back to him as tiny fragments, and sometimes he does things without being aware of them at all."
"Is he dangerous?"
"He would already be getting prepared for rehabilitation back into society if he'd shown any indication that that's what he wants," Neil says.
"He doesn't want to get out? Is that what you're saying?" Margot asks.
"We start socializing most of our inmates fairly early. They get a chance to meet people outside the hospital, have supervised excursions, but he mostly keeps to himself and won't accept any visitors. He never phones anyone, writes no letters, and doesn't use the internet," the doctor says.
"Does he talk to the other patients?"
"Sometimes, as I understand it," Neil replies.
"I need to know which patients have been discharged from Section D4 during the time he's been there," she says, sitting down on the chair she sat on earlier. She looks round Neil's tidy office while he searches his computer. He's got no photographs on display, no books or ornaments.
"Have you found anything?"
she asks, and can hear how anxious her voice sounds.
Neil turns the screen to show her.
"Not much," he says. "That section has a very low turnover of patients.
There are a few who have been moved to other psychiatric institutions, but we've only had two inmates discharged in the time Rocky has been here.
Two in 9 years? That's normal, the doctor says.
Margot opens her leather bag, takes out her notebook, and writes the names down.
Now I want to see Rocky Sjöklund, she says.
Chapter 53.
Two guards with emergency alarms, batons, and tasers on their belts accompany Margot through the airlocks and into the corridor where Rocky Sjöklund's section is located. He is sitting on the bunk in his room watching a Formula One race on a television fixed to the wall up near the ceiling. The shimmering cars move round the track like dragonflies with their bursts of speed and metallic colours.
My name is Margot Silverman. I'm a superintendent with the National Criminal Investigation Department, she explains, leaning back against his desk chair.
Adam fucked Eve, and then she got pregnant and gave birth to Cain, Rocky says, looking at her stomach.
I've come here from Stockholm to talk to you.
You're not observing the day of rest,
Rocky states, then looks back at the television.
Are you?
She asks, pulling the chair out and sitting down.
What have you done today?
His face is calm. His nose looks like it was broken at some point. His cheeks are covered by a grey beard, and there are folds in his thick neck.
Have you been out today?
She asks, and waits a moment before going on. You haven't been out in the exercise yard, but perhaps there are other ways of getting out.
Rocky Sjöklund shows no reaction. His eyes are following the cars on the screen. One of the guards by the door shifts his weight, and the keys on his belt jangle.
Who have you been in contact with on the outside? She asks. Friends? Relatives? Other patients?
The turbo engines roar. They sound like chainsaws cutting through dry wood, over and over again. Margot looks at his stockinged feet, the worn heels, and clumsy darning of one sock.
I've been told that you don't see any visitors.
Rocky doesn't answer. His stomach rises and falls calmly under his denim shirt. One hand is resting between his legs, and he's leaning back against two pillows.
But you do have personal contact with the staff. Some of them have worked here for many years. You must have got to know each other, haven't you?
Rocky Sjöklund remains silent.
On the television, a Ferrari driver comes into the pits at speed. Before his car has even stopped, the crew are ready to change his tires.
You have your meals with patients from other sections, and you share the exercise yard. Who do you like best, if you had to say a name?
A Bible with about 60 bookmarks in the form of red thread is lying on the bedside table. Beside it stands a dirty milk glass. Light, filtered by the trees, comes through the vertical bars on the window. Margot shifts position uncomfortably on the chair and takes the notebook containing the names of the two discharged patients out of her bag.
Do you remember Jens Romberg? Marek Semyovich? She asks. You do, don't you?
One car collides with another and spins round in a cloud of smoke while parts of the car fly across the track.
Do you have any memory of what you were doing earlier today?
She waits a while, then stands up again as the accident is replayed on the screen, its glow reflecting off Rocky's face and chest. The guards don't meet her gaze as they leave the room together. Rocky doesn't seem to notice her departure. As she walks back towards the car park, she can feel the technician watching her on one of the 30 cameras. Before she drives back, she sits in the car
and reads through the material about the murder of Rebecca Hansson, and thinks that Rocky Kirkland must be involved in the new murders in some way, if only as a sort of distant Rodief. Margot sees that Eric Maria Burke was part of the team that conducted the forensic psychiatric evaluation of Kirkland. Their conclusions, which formed the basis of the sentence, were based upon long conversations between Eric and Rocky. Eric evidently managed to gain his trust. She notes that he has taken part in almost 100 forensic psychiatric evaluations and has been called as an expert witness during 40 trials. Chapter 54. Adam Youssef is sitting in his car next to his wife Katrina. She's massaging her hands, and the smell of her hand cream is spreading through the car. It's starting to get dark, and the traffic on Valhallavegen is fairly light. They've been to the Dramatic Institute to watch her brother Fuad's performance about post-punk group The Cure. The middle-aged singer, Robert Smith, was depicted sitting without any makeup on a carousel horse, talking about his years at Notre Dame Middle School. Adam stops at a red light and looks at Katrina. She's plucked her eyebrows a bit too much, making her face look rather cruel. "You're not saying anything," he says. She shrugs her shoulders. He looks at her nails. She's painted them in a color that shifts from violet to pink at their tips. He ought to say something about them. "Katrina," he says. "What is it?" She looks him in the eye with a seriousness that makes him scared. "I don't want to have the baby," she explains. "You don't?" She shakes her head, and the red light disappears from her face. He turns back towards the traffic light. It's turned green, but he can't bring himself to drive on. "I'm not sure I want children at all," she whispers. "You've only just got pregnant," he says helplessly. "Can't you wait? See if you change your mind?" "I'm not going to," she says simply. He nods and swallows. A car blows its horn a couple of times before overtaking on the right, and then the light goes red again. He looks at the switch for the hazard warning lights, but can't be bothered to press it. "Okay," he says. "I've made up my mind. I've booked an appointment to have an abortion next week." "Do you want me to come with you?" "There's no need." "But I could wait in the car while—" "I don't want you there," she interrupts. He stares at the cars driving across the junction in front of them, then at some black birds flying overhead. They're describing a wide arc in front of Stockholm's Olympic Stadium. He's losing her. It's already happening. Recently, he's been trying to show her he loves her every day. They love each other, after all. They really do. Or at least he thought they did. What if she's lying when she says she's going out with her workmates at Sephora after work every Thursday? She never talks about it, and he hasn't been interested enough to ask or go along. The light goes green again, and he moves his foot onto the accelerator and drives on. They're approaching Sveavägen when his phone rings. "Can you look and see who it is?" She picks up the phone from the pocket by the gear stick and turns it over. "It's your boss." Adam looks away from the traffic for a moment before taking the phone. "Margot," he says in a weak voice. "It's the same deer," she says. The broken edge of the deer in Sandra's room has been matched with the little head found in Susanna Kern's hand, 100%. "It seemed completely mad when we saw it on the video," Margot says, sounding like she's panting for breath. "But all it means is that the murders are planned long before they take place. That someone has recorded them and then waited, possibly for weeks." "But why?" Adam asks, feeling his hand sweating on the wheel. The murders are following each other like a string of pearls, a ring of roses, he thinks. The order of death is ordained long before anyone pulls the trigger. That ought to give us more time, in theory, but not in practice, seeing as the murderer doesn't upload the videos until it's too late for us to identify the scene or the woman. I found some similarities with an old case, Margot says.
What did you say?
Are you listening?
Yes, sorry.
He looks at Katrina's face, turned away from him, as he listens to Margot tell him about the similarities with an old murder in Salem, about the priest who was found guilty, about Rebecca Hanson's ravaged face and arranged posture. She explains that she's checked the security arrangements at Karsuden and that it seems impossible that anyone could have got out without it being discovered. So, he must have an accomplice, a disciple, unless it's a copycat.
Okay, Adam says hesitantly.
Do you think I'm making too much of this?
Maybe,
he says honestly. I can understand that, but right now it doesn't matter. You'll see what I mean when you take a look.
Do you want us to go and have a word with the priest? Adam asks.
I'm on my way back from there now.
Weren't you and Jenny supposed to be having some sort of big dinner today?
That's next weekend, she says curtly.
So what did he say then?
Nothing. He didn't even look at me, she says.
It appears I'm completely devoid of interest.
Nice, Adam says.
That seems to be par for the course with him, she says tolerantly.
That was why they brought Eric Maria Bark into the team conducting the forensic psychiatric examination. He gets people to talk.
Apart from our witness, Adam points out.
Practically the entire investigation had its foundations in his conversations with Kirklund, Margot explains. It's a huge amount of material. We're going to have to get people to examine every last detail.
How long's that going to take?
That's why I'm on my way to see Eric Maria Bark now, Margot says.
Now?
Well, I'm already in the car, so...
So am I,
Adam laughs. But I'm certainly not thinking of... I have to say... It would be brilliant to have you there, she interrupts amiably. Chapter 55. Eric is sitting in his reading chair with a copy of the Swedish Psychiatric Association's journal in his lap, thinking about dinner at Nelly and Martin's. They invite him round fairly often, to their huge modernist house with its curved windows and a terrace that looks like the bridge of an old sailing yacht. After dinner, Martin took off his tie and led them through the house, clutching a glass of Calvados in his hand. In his study, he had a fairly small oil painting he had just been given by his aunt in Westphalia. It was of a gloomy-looking angel. Nelly thought it was horrible and tried to offer it to Eric. Martin agreed with her, but Eric declined the offer, because it was obvious that he wanted to keep it, really. When Martin had to take a call from Sydney, Eric and Nelly went to the billiard room. Nelly poured more wine. She was already fairly drunk. Her eyes were moist, and she was leaning against the raised edge of the table.
"Martin looks at porn," she slurred.
"Why do you think that?" Eric asked, rolling a ball across the green bays.
"I don't care. It's nothing perverse."
"Does it make you sad?"
"Not jealous, but I don't know. You should see the women. They're young and beautiful, and they do things I'd never dare to try," she said, reaching out and touching his lips.
"Talk to him."
"Is youth the only thing that counts?" she drawled.
"Not to me."
"What does matter, then? What do you want? What does any man really want?" she said, swaying slightly.
He helped her to her bedroom, but left before she took off her mocha-colored dress. When Nelly called him to discuss two Iranian patients from the unit for survivors of torture out in Donderid, he took the opportunity to thank her for dinner. She just laughed and said he should be grateful she didn't get too drunk and embarrassing. Now Eric leans back in his armchair and thinks about the bottle of champagne in the fridge that he opened earlier, all alone. He sealed it with some argon, a noble gas that will have kept it tasting like new if he were to have a glass now. "That would get rid of my headache," Eric thinks, as he sees the car headlights sweep in through the large glass window. With a short sigh, he gets up and puts the journal on the smoking table, leaves his slippers on the floor, and goes to open the door. He watches Margot struggle out of her car and wave to him. Then another car pulls into the drive. A younger man with short dark hair hurries over to Margot and exchanges a few words with her. Behind the pair of them comes a beautiful young woman with clear eyes and a serious face. Eric shakes hands with Margot and the young man, whom she introduces as a colleague working on the murder investigation with her. The young woman hesitates in the doorway. Her black coat is shiny with rain, and she looks frozen. "I didn't have time to take my wife home," Adam explains, looking unexpectedly awkward. "This is Katrina."
"Adam didn't want me to wait in the car," she says softly.
"You're more than welcome to come in," Eric says, shaking her hand.
"Thank you."
"What wonderful fingernails," he says, holding onto her hand to look at them for a few seconds. She smiles in surprise, and her dark eyes warm up instantly. Eric invites them to take their coats off, then steps into the porch to close the front door properly. The gentle rain is dripping rhythmically through the leaves of the lilac. The road is shimmering under the streetlights, and suddenly he imagines he can see the silhouette of a tall figure in his own garden. He switches the outside light on, thinking that it must have been the scrawny juniper next to the wheelbarrow. Eric shuts the door and shows them into the library, where Katrina stops, looking a little embarrassed.
"I'm probably not supposed to overhear your conversation," she says.
"You can sit here if you like," Eric says, pulling a folio off the shelf. "I don't know about you, but I'm a bit addicted to Caravaggio." He puts the art book down on the table, then shows the detectives into his study. Adam closes the door behind them. "We found a third victim today," Margot says at once. "A third victim," Eric says. "We were expecting it, but it's still a blow." She looks down towards her stomach, and the corners of her mouth twitch slightly, possibly from exhaustion. She has a deep frown on her forehead that stretches down between her eyebrows.
"What can I help you with?" Eric asks neutrally. "Do you know a man called Rocky Sherklund?" Margot asks, looking up at him.
"Should I?"
"You ought to know that he was sentenced to psychiatric care after a forensic psychiatric evaluation 9 years ago."
"Of course. I'm sure that's right," Eric says gently.
As soon as she mentioned Rocky's name, it occurred to him that she might know everything, that he's been found out. "You were part of the team," Margot explains.
"Okay," Eric says.
"He's spent hours conjuring up different scenarios in which he's confronted with what happened, and then imagining possible reactions and answers that couldn't be regarded as lies, even though they keep him out of it. And we have reason to believe that he confided in you."
"I don't remember that, but
he had murdered a woman in Salem, in a way that's reminiscent of the murders that I'm currently investigating," Margot says, without further elaboration.
"If he's been released and is killing again, then something has gone very wrong with the parole process," Eric replies, just as he had planned.
"He hasn't been released.
He's still in Karsuden, and he hasn't left the facility at all, she says. I've just been out there and spoken to the head of security.
Chapter 56. Margot opens her leather bag and hands Eric a copy of the verdict and the forensic psychiatric evaluation. The standard lamp shines warmly off the polished oak floor and leather binding of the volumes in the built-in bookcases. It's so dark outside the leaded windows that the fruit tree's dense network of branches is completely invisible. Eric sits down opposite Adam at the little octagonal table, leafs through the material, nods, and looks up.
Yes, I remember him.
We think he has an apprentice, a disciple, maybe a copycat.
That's possible. If the similarities are that strong, well, I can't actually give an opinion.
Margot shakes her wrist to get her watch in the right place. I spoke to Rocky Shirklund today, she says. I asked him a lot of questions, but he just sat there in silence on his bed, staring at the television.
He suffered serious brain damage, Eric says, gesturing towards the old evaluation.
He could hear and understand everything I said. He just didn't want to answer.
Margot smiles. It's often rather difficult to start with when you're dealing with this sort of patient.
She leans forward so that her stomach ends up resting on her thighs. Can you help us?
How?
Talk to him. He trusted you before. You know him.
Eric's heart starts to beat faster. He mustn't show any feelings, so slowly clasps his hands together to stop them shaking.
They're probably going to find the tape recordings of the forensic psychiatric evaluation in which Rocky talks about his alibi. But because Rocky is guilty, Eric can always say that he didn't take the idea of an alibi seriously, if it comes up.
What do you want to know?
We want to know who he was working with.
Eric nods and thinks that he'll be free at last after this. He'll no longer have to carry the burden of knowledge that he can't offload. He can tell them about the person Rocky blamed, whether or not Rocky just sits there in silence. He could even hypnotize Björn Kern again, and then tell them about the hand clasped to Susanna's ear.
Naturally, this is rather outside my usual remit, he begins.
Of course we'd pay.
That's not what I meant.
I need to know the outline of the task, so I know what to say to my employers.
Margot nods, with her lips half open, as though she were about to say something, but decides against it.
And I need to know what to say to the patient, Eric goes on. I mean, am I allowed to let him know that you think his former associate has started killing again?
Margot waves her hand. Eric notes that her colleague seems to have stiffened slightly as he sits there with his arms folded.
We'll have to see if we can give any room for negotiation, Margot says. We don't know yet, of course, but you might be able to offer him supervised excursions outside the hospital.
She falls silent as if she's run out of breath. Her hand goes to her stomach. Her thin wedding ring sits tightly around her swollen finger.
What did you say to him today? Eric asks.
I asked which people he had most contact with.
Does he know why you were asking?
No. He didn't react at all to anything I said.
He has epileptic activity in his brain, which affects his memory. And according to his diagnosis, he suffers from a narcissistic paranoid disorder. But all the evidence suggests that he's intelligent.
Eric falls silent. What are you thinking? Margot asks.
I'd like the authority to be able to tell him why I'm asking him these questions.
Tell him about the serial killer?
He'll probably work out that I'm lying otherwise. Margot, Adam says.
I have to... What?
He looks troubled as he lowers his voice.
This is police work, he says.
We haven't got a choice,
she says curtly.
I just think you're going too far now, Adam says.
Am I?
First you get Una Linna mixed up in this, and now you're going to let a hypnotist do police work?
Una Linna? Eric asks. I'm not talking to you, Adam says.
He's back, Margot says.
Where?
Back probably isn't the right word, Adam says. He's living with the Romanian Roma out in Hüdinge. He's an alcoholic, and
we don't know that, she interrupts.
Okay, Yuna's best, Adam says.
Margot meets Eric's quizzical gaze.
Yuna fainted and ended up in A&E at St. Jöran's, she says.
When?
Eric asks, getting to his feet.
Yesterday.
Eric immediately picks up his phone and dials the number of a colleague in the hospital's intensive care unit and waits as the call goes through.
When can you talk to Rocky?
Margot asks, standing up.
I'll head out there first thing tomorrow,
Eric says, as his colleague answers the phone. Chapter 57.
After a short conversation with the doctor at St. Jöran's Hospital, Eric accompanies the two detectives to the door. Katrina and Adam don't look at each other as they walk out into the hall, and Eric gets the distinct impression that they've had a row. The three of them leave the house and are swallowed up by the darkness as soon as they move beyond the circle of light in front of the door. Eric hears their footsteps on the gravel path leading to the drive. Then they come into view again when the insides of their cars light up. He returns to his study and sees that the fax of the emergency records has arrived, and that, in line with correct procedure, the patient's name and ID number have been blanked out. Yuna arrived by ambulance after a priority one call from the emergency command center. Eric glances through the records of his blood pressure, heartbeat, breathing frequency, oxygenation, temperature, and level of consciousness. He was suffering from malnutrition, fever, confusion, and poor circulation. The triage nurse made the right call from the available evidence when she suspected that he was suffering from blood poisoning. After checking his blood gases and lactic acid, she allocated him triage level orange, the second highest level of priority. Because of his variable vital signs, Una Linna was placed in a room under close supervision and attached to a monitor. While they were waiting for the results of his blood analysis, they gave him broad-spectrum antibiotics and a colloid solution to help his circulation and fluid balance. But Una disappeared before the antibiotics could take effect. He hadn't given an address. Given his symptoms, his condition was life-threatening unless he received treatment. Eric leaves his study and picks up his jacket in the hall. He doesn't bother to switch the lights off. It's no longer raining. The night air is cool and the car windows are covered with condensation. He turns the windscreen wipers on and waits for them to clear the screen before he drives off. It's close to midnight, and the streets are almost empty. Beyond the yellow glow of the street lamps, beyond the speed cameras and barriers and noise reduction screens, the late summer night is as dark as heavy velvet. He drives down Sturengsleden, turns onto Centralwegen towards Dalhemsvegen, heading into an industrial area with high fences, then emerges into a patch of woodland. There never used to be any beggars in Sweden, but over the past few years, migrants from the EU have become visible in Swedish towns and cities. They've come here to plead for help, on their knees, in the snow, outside supermarkets, with outstretched hands and empty paper cups. It struck Eric several times that modern Swedes have reacted with unexpected generosity to this change,
considering the country's dark history of discrimination and enforced sterilization. There are faint lights between the trees. He slows down and drives towards them, turning onto a gravel track, and the tiny monkey attached to his ignition key bounces up and down. In a clearing, he can see sheets flapping on a rope strung between two trees. Lengths of plywood have been nailed together and covered with tarpaulin and plastic. Eric turns round and parks with two wheels on the verge. He locks up and walks away from the car, staring in amongst the trees. The air smells of potatoes and liquid gas. Four battered caravans are standing in a row, with crooked wooden shacks between them. Smoke is rising from a buckled oil drum. Glowing embers drift up, spreading a stench of burning plastic. Yuna Linna is here somewhere, Eric thinks. He's got advanced blood poisoning and is going to die unless he gets the right antibiotics very soon. No other person on the planet has done as much for Eric as the tall detective. A woman with a shawl over her head gives him a wary look and hurries away as he approaches. He carries on towards the first caravan and knocks on the door. On a beautiful rug beneath the caravan stand five shabby pairs of trainers of various sizes.
Yuna,
Eric says loudly and knocks again. The caravan sways slightly, and then the door is opened by an old man with eyes made cloudy by cataracts. Behind him sits a child on a mattress. On the floor, a woman is asleep, fully dressed in a woolly hat and a winter coat.
Yuna,
Eric says in a subdued voice. A thick-set man in a padded tunic suddenly appears behind him and asks what he wants in broken Swedish.
I'm looking for a friend of mine. His name is Yuna Linna, Eric says. We don't want problems,
the man says with an anxious look.
Okay,
Eric says, and walks over to the second caravan and knocks on the door. It's covered with circular scorch marks as if people had stubbed cigarettes out on it. A young woman in glasses cautiously opens the door. She's wearing a thick sweater and baggy sweatpants with damp knees. I'm looking for a sick friend, Eric says.
Next house, she whispers with a frightened look in her eyes.
A tired child has come over and pokes at Eric with a plastic crocodile. Eric steps across two crutches lying on the ground and walks up to the third caravan. The windows are broken and covered with pieces of cardboard. In the darkness between the trees, an unshaven, tired-looking man is smoking a cigarette. Eric knocks on the door and opens it when there's no answer. In the glow of a clock radio, he sees his friend. Yuna Linna is lying on a damp mattress with a folded blanket as a pillow. An old woman in an old-fashioned quilted jacket is sitting beside him, trying to get him to drink some water from a spoon.
Yuna,
he says quietly. The floor creaks as Eric climbs inside the caravan. The water in a plastic bucket sloshes with the movement. The carpet on the floor is wet with rain by the door, and there's a strong smell of damp and cigarette smoke. There are scraps of bluish-grey cloth covering the cardboard-patched windows. As Eric moves further inside, he sees a crucifix on the wall. Yuna's face is emaciated, covered by a grey beard, and his chest looks unnaturally sunken. His eyes look yellow, and his gaze is so unfocused that Eric isn't sure if he's actually conscious.
I'm going to give you an injection before we leave, Eric says, putting his bag down on the floor.
Yuna barely reacts when Eric pulls his sleeve up, wipes the crook of his arm with a swab, looks for a vein, and then injects a mixture of benzyl penicillin and aminoglycoside. Can you stand up? He asks, as he puts a plaster where he stuck the needle. Yuna lifts his head slightly and coughs emptily. Eric helps him get up on one knee. A tin can rolls across the floor. Yuna coughs again, points at the woman, and tries to say something.
I can't hear,
Eric says.
Krina needs to be paid,
Yuna hisses and stands up.
She's helped me.
Eric nods and takes his wallet out. He gives the woman a 500 kroner note, and she nods and smiles with her lips closed. Eric opens the door and helps Yuna down the steps. A bald man in a crumpled suit stands outside and holds the caravan door open for them.
Thanks,
Eric says. From the other direction, a blonde man in a black shiny jacket is approaching. He's hiding something behind his back. Beside the next caravan stands a third man with a soot-stained saucepan in his hand. He's wearing jeans and a denim waistcoat, and his bare arms are dark with tattoos.
You've got a nice car,
he calls out with a grin. Eric and Yuna start to walk towards the road, but the blonde man blocks their path.
We need some rent, he says.
I've already paid, Eric says.
The bald man shouts into the caravan, and the old woman comes to the door and holds up the money she has just been given. The man snatches the note, says something angrily, then spits at her.
We have to collect rent from everyone here,
the blonde man explains, showing the length of metal pipe in his hand. Eric mutters in agreement and thinks it would be best just to try to get to the car when Yuna stops.
Give the money back to her,
he says, pointing at the bald man.
I own the caravans, the blonde man says. I own all this, every mattress, every single fucking saucepan.
I'm not talking to you,
Yuna says, and coughs into the crook of his arm.
It's not worth it,
Eric whispers, his heart pounding in his chest.
For fuck's sake, we've got a deal with them, the tattooed man shouts.
Eric, get in the car,
Yuna says, and limps over to the men.
It costs more now,
the blonde man says.
I've got a bit more money, Eric says, taking his wallet out.
Don't do it, Yuna says.
Eric gives a few more notes to the blonde man.
That's not enough, he says.
Give it all back, Yuna tells the blonde man feebly.
It's only money, Eric says quickly, and pulls out the last couple of notes.
Not to Krina, Yuna says.
Run home and hide before we change our minds,